Good day, and welcome to the quarterly All Employment Network call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Carol Cohen. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Yes, hello everybody, and welcome. We're so pleased to have you join us. We know this will be a very informative and very interesting joint call. So we're so glad that the ENs have taken a bit of time out of their very busy days and joined us. So with that, I am absolutely delighted to introduce my colleague, the wonderful Tom Hale, who is an economist with the Policy Office, and he's going to discuss with us a particular demonstration. And you may be aware that we engage in demonstrations to inform policy and to determine whether, in fact, certain applications or certain uses of, or manipulations, I should say, of benefits and incentives will improve the way we do business and improve return to work. So with that, Tom.
Well, thank you very much, Carol. My name is Tom Hale. As Carol mentioned, I'm an economist that's the COTAR, the Contract Office's Technical Representative for this contract, and Taffy McCoy, sitting by my side, is my alternate COTAR. Her main job is to check to see that I'm still breathing every day. Happy.
So far,
it's
so good.
It's a good day today.
By way of background, we awarded this contract to a company named Westat back in 2016, August. And the period of performance for this contract runs from 6 years, from August till August 22. We're basically going to evaluate whether or not offering these evidence-based package of integrated vocational, medical, and behavioral services will get people back to work, contribute to their self-sufficiency, result in somewhat improved mental health and certainly a better quality of life by virtue of the fact that they get some independence. I'm sorry. I'm on slide 5. I've missed this, the one beginning introduction. I'll be better about my protocol, which I've forgotten already. basically, we have a set of interventions to get people back to work. And this slide lays out what they are. The first major one is long-term employment services based on the individual placement and support model. This is the only evidence-based return-to-work employment support model out there. There are several others like Are You Ready? You know, when people say that they're ready. But this one, there's actually a rigorous set of protocols for how to do this. It's been tested in probably 30 independent tests, including our own. Which we did, the mental health treatment study, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. The IPS, Individual Placement and Support Services, include job placement and pre- and post-placement support services. These individual placement and support managers, I guess you call them, they're kind of like job counselors, they already have strong employer contacts in the community and the capacity to place participants in these jobs. In fact, you'll see we're going to be in 30 community mental health sites, and these places were selected because of their fidelity to that protocol. They already had the protocol in place, and they're basically already doing it. A couple of other interventions, however, that they weren't. So the last bullet there, the health-related treatments include behavioral health-related services, integrated medication management, and health management care services. And without getting into too much detail, basically we will buy whatever person needs to get back to work. You know, a lot of these folks perhaps don't have front teeth. We'll give them teeth, dentures, glasses, a license, training, whatever can reasonably be expected to help them get back to work. And the point of that is, you know, it's of course the humane thing to do, but we know that people need these things in place in order to be successful in a job search, particularly this group of people. Next slide. The population includes a group of people. I'm not going to take these. I'm not going to read the slides to you. They're basically people who were denied applicants. They applied for SSI, SSDI on the basis of a mental impairment, and they were denied. They were denied very often because their condition wasn't sufficiently severe, and I'm not sure what that means in the case of schizophrenia. Some of them were denied because they were working above SGA, and we wanted to test that because the point here is not only to get people back to work who either never worked before or had to leave the labor force, but I think there's a bigger goal than that, and it's sustaining employment. So if you get somebody who's working above SGA, they were denied benefits because of that. We know that earnings are episodic. There's a good chance they're going to drop below SGA and may be eligible, but we can give them the supports to sustain employment, which we think is an important goal. These individuals are going to be between age 18 and 50 who apply for benefits within, and we'll get their name and try to recruit them within 2 months of them having been denied benefits. So if they just left the labor force or they still have some marginal attachment to the labor force, there's a good chance of getting them, keeping them in. This says that recruitment began in October. It actually began just 2 days ago. The slides are a bit dated. I should have updated those. But by recruitment, what we mean is the letters go out inviting people to attend a meeting where we'll tell them about the demonstration. We're going to enroll 3,000 people in three groups. There are two treatment groups and one control group. In the last slide, when we get to that, we'll show you what those are. So there's 3,000 people. There are 30 community mental health sites, and these are sites that were already up and running and doing their thing. And SSA's contractor, Westat, engaged in subcontracts with these 30 sites to provide them services. And we're paying them on an annual basis to participate. So, for instance, we have systematic medication management. Our participants automatically buy into systematic med management, meaning also that we'll give them a psychiatrist if they don't have one. A previous study that we conducted, and I guess I don't have this on a slide, what is called the mental health treatment study. It was basically the same study, but those were people that were beneficiaries initially, so they were allowed based on affective disorder, bipolar or major depression and schizophrenia. So the interventions worked very, very nicely for those people. We were definitely successful at getting them back to work, but we don't think we got them early enough. For instance, we wanted people to be on Medicare so we wouldn't have to pay for their insurance. And, you know, there's a 2-year waiting period. So in some cases, people were already on the rolls for 2 years before we recruited them. And then by then, they've kind of lost their attachment to the labor force. So we're getting these people early, within 2 months of their denial. And we know full and well that they're going to go back and reapply. In fact, we've got benefit counselors that were trained by this very office who I expect will tell them you need to reapply, which is why I thought it was important to brief this audience, because if they reapply and they are allowed, then they're going to be for you, right? The EENs. And by the way, I might mention for the supported employment study, there are 30 community mental health sites. Two of them are already EENs, and I don't know if they're on the call or not, but we're talking to this office and finding out whether or not it's an erstwhile thing for the other 28 sites to become ENs. In the mental health treatment study, virtually none of the 23 sites were ENs, but this office came and briefed my community mental health sites, and every one of them signed up. All 23 signed up to be ENs, and they are ENs to this day. The catchment area where we're taking our people from live around these community mental health sites. So basically, we sent the zip codes out to the contractor of the people who were recently denied. They're able to match them up with a ring around the community mental health site, those zip codes, and we can start drawing people from as close to these sites as we can, so travel costs can be substantial, even though they might be nothing for us, but for this population, we want to get people that are close to the sites. And then people are randomly assigned to either one of two treatment groups or the control group. Next slide. So this slide shows you what the treatment groups are, the three study arms. We have usual services, which is the control group. So we basically, I've always thought it's kind of an odd thing. We bring people in for the recruitment meeting. We tell them, here's what you could get. You could get teeth, glasses, training, license, whatever you need, unless you're in the control group, in which case we'll give you this little pamphlet, and that's where you could go get help yourself. So really, people are very brave, I think, to do this. They'll say, okay, I'll go through this randomization process, and then, you know, in this case, a third of them aren't going to get anything out of the study, but knowing full and well. So why would people do that? Well, we appeal to their contribution to science, for one thing, all the other people behind them that would benefit from a study like this. So we have very good adherence in these control groups. People show up for quarterly interviews, let us know what they're doing and all of that. In fact, at a higher rate than the actual participants in the study. They get a few bucks, you know, would be enough for me to go, but, you know. So let me tell you now about the basic services. We wanted to have two treatment arms to prove or to demonstrate that perhaps we could get the same results for about two-thirds the money. So this basic services group gets the individual placement and support. That's the main intervention. That's, you know, where you start thinking about a job right away, what kind of job you want. But you don't have to go apply for a job until you're ready to get a job, and then whatever you need once you get it. So they get that. And they get this behavioral health and employment-related services. And that's the business of if you need the glasses, the license, the training, you'll get that as well, but nothing else. The full services treatment arm gets the services of a nurse care coordinator. Nurse care coordinator coordinates the physical and mental therapies of these participants. If you've been in a setting like this, the psychiatrist is going to say one thing that nobody in that community mental health site really understands. And then they get a doc for their physical therapies, and you got the same problem. And then the doc for the psychiatric problems doesn't talk to the doc who's dealing with the physical problems. So the nurse care coordinator basically coordinates all of that stuff, including coordination with the community staff, and SSA is paying for that position. Systematic medication management, the upshot of that one is for many people with a psychiatric disorder, they go and see a psychiatrist, he writes them out a script, it doesn't work. They go back to the psychiatrist, he gets another script, that one doesn't work. Goes back to the psychiatrist, and the doctor writes out a prescription for the first medication that didn't work. They don't keep track, and they don't systematically know what drugs they need, what the protocol is for, what the sequence of drugs is, and what the dosage is over a period of time. There are protocols for schizophrenia, bipolar, and affective disorder, and probably now for several other mental impairments for, you know, the protocol is what drugs you take when and what fails and what's the dosage. And then, of course, we're giving assistance with behavioral health and employment-related services. That's the same thing I said before, the license, the training, the teeth, the glasses, whatever you need to get a job. Something else has changed on this, but we are, you know, what's happened to Affordable Care Act in the last even 2 months. Subsidies were removed. Remember, these are people who applied for benefits but were denied, and only a small slice of them were denied because they're working above SGA. So we're looking at people that do have a mental impairment. You know, one of the things that could come out of a decision is no mental impairment, right? You don't have that. You thought you did, but you don't have that. But these people do have a mental impairment, and likely it's going to get worse down the road. So what we thought is a lot of them would come in without insurance. So we put in the original contract that we'd buy insurance for them. Then once we awarded the contract and we started checking it out, we found out, well, the insurance that you buy outside of the open window likely doesn't cover pre-existing conditions. And that's exactly why we would be sending these people. They have a psychiatric impairment, and they need to see a psychiatrist, and the insurance we buy for them doesn't do it for them. So what we're looking at now is reimbursing expenses for these people. We're going to send them to these clinics where they have a sliding scale for depending on what your income is, and Social Security Administration will pay whatever that clinic is charging. We will negotiate cheaper rates with these clinics. You know, the fact that SSA is paying still means that if that person's living 134% below the poverty level, or even above the poverty level, rather, that they get the sliding scale. So that's what we'll be doing for those folks. And finally, the timeline, I won't get into this. I'm sorry, next slide. Thank you. The timeline, it's a first year, we stand up the demo. We had to make contracts, establish provider networks. We have these community resource manuals that are available, and they'll be available online as well, where we contact these 30 community mental health sites and ask them to draw up a list of all the services that are available for people with mental impairments in that area. And by the way, that is one thing that the control group gets. They get a list of that. We are not specifically identifying which sites we're at, because the main reason is we don't want people from the control group to walk into one of our sites and ask for the services that we're providing to our treatment group, because that would contaminate the study. So we'll say we're in Kansas City, we're in New York City, we're in Boston, but we're not going to identify which site in those places that we're at. So we've got the first year is basically done. OMB clearance, all of our surveys. We the data collection, there's an initial survey, and then there are quarterly interviews for the length of the people's participation in the study, including the control group. So that's where the meat of our data come from, besides the administrative stuff. 17 and 18, the subcontracts are established. They're done. All of the contracts are in place, and all the sites are up and running. And we started recruitment just last week, meaning we sent out the letters. We're doing an early assessment report after the first year where we've got implementation. So we can – it's very important for 30 sites to be doing things in pretty much the same way, because we don't want the variability of one site doing it differently to affect or to confuse or confound the results. You know, this site got more employment than another one. Is it because they did things differently? No, basically we want everybody to do things the same way. So we'll have this meeting with the site managers, I guess you'd call them, following this early assessment project. 18 through 20 is the full implementation and delivery of the services, including we have technical assistance. We all have all kinds of training. One of the training, for instance, is there's a smartphone application. It's geared to people who are using the individual placement support. It reminds our participants of their important appointments, but it also does things like tells them how to deal with difficult people on a job. So it's a pretty cool app, and I should make it available to you folks. Seriously.
I could probably use it.
For all of us, you know. And that's basically it. At the end of the project, we'll give people a transition plan. One of the things, for instance, that happened in the mental health treatment study is you know how the pharmaceutical companies will walk into the psychiatrist's office and load up the shelves with what they want to sell. One of those drugs that they gave them was Abilify, and we had a lot of people on Abilify. Well, the first call out of CMS is, we won't pay for people's Abilify when they come out of your study. So we were paying for it when they were in. Problem with that is, you know, you cut a person's psychotropic meds off, they might get suicidal, depressed, or worse, have headaches, and it's an inhumane thing to do. So we want to watch that. But by the way, CMS rolled back that rule, and they will, if they say you've been on this and you never had anything else, we will continue to pay for your Abilify. So we have a transition plan that identifies the community resources, identifies where people are going to get psychotropic meds if they need it, and whatever other resources they need. Well, that's basically my synopsis of the supported employment demo. So I'd like to open it up to questions, if I may.
Yes, that's great. Thank you so much, Tom. And while we're compiling that list, Bethany, for questions, there is one in the chat. Is it public information to know where the 30 sites are located for SED?
We're not identifying where the specific sites are because, as I said, we don't want people from the control group walking into one of our sites and asking for the same services we're giving the treatment group because it would confound the study. But we do identify the communities that they're in, the towns they're in. I'm from Suffolk County on Long Island, and completely coincidence, there's about four sites in my hometown. The junior high school, where I went to junior high school, is now a community mental health site, which just blows my mind. You know. Right. I have to go on there. I do.
That it was total coincidence.
It was, you know, being the co-tar, I could say, well, I want you to get my junior high school in there. But no, it didn't work like that. But that's the reason we're not identifying the specific sites. And by the way, if you go on to SSA's webpage, I don't know, I'll tell you what, just Google Supported Employment Demonstration, Social Security Administration, and the website will come up and it identifies the towns that the study is going to be in.
Okay, great.
Not the cities, the town. Well, in my case, where I'm from, it's town, the town of Huntington. So the towns ain't so bad, you know, but most of these towns have... Oh, that's all it is? Okay. Well, the towns are available. We could probably get that, but not the specific site. I'm curious, it's difficult to ask a question. I wonder if the two sites that are in our study that are ENs are in on the phone call. But there are two of our sites currently are ENs. I wasn't able to communicate with them directly to tell them about this call.
Okay. Well, we'll be sure to have this information available. Bethany, have you had a chance to queue up any questions from our participants today?
Not at this time, but ladies and gentlemen, that is star one to ask a question over the phones.
And I did see that Deb did post a question as their website link, and John has graciously posted that. Thank you for that question.
There's also an intranet page if anybody's interested in that as well.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, what we'll do at this time is thank you so much, Tom
thank
and
you.
Kathy. That was wonderful information. If any questions come up later, we'll gather those and send them over and then post them over the call.
Very good. It'd be nice to get back to this group in a year or so and let you know how it's going.
All right. Wonderful. Thank you again so much.
Thanks very much, everybody. Bye-bye.
Carol, I'll hand it over to you. Hi, Carol. No worries. I will go ahead and hand the call over for our next section, and this will be about work and census planning and assistance, and I will hand it over to Marjorie.
Thank you, Adele. Hi, everybody. My name is Marjorie McKeever, and I am a project officer here in the Office of Beneficiary Outreach and Employment Support, and today we're going to focus on work incentive planning assistance projects. We refer to them as WIPAs. And, John, if you wouldn't mind going to the first slide, the next slide, sorry, slide 10. Thank you. So I'm going to start the discussion, and about halfway through I'm going to turn it over to my colleague Terry Odermullen, who will also provide some information, and then we'll be available for some questions. And we know that most of you are familiar with the WIPA program, but we thought it might be helpful to give you a better idea of where WIPA fits into the back-to-work service system, when it's appropriate to refer beneficiaries to a WIPA program, and the best way to make that referral. So we also want to give you a better idea of the difference between the important work reports you make in order to receive payments and the responsibility that beneficiaries have to report work to Social Security. And finally, we'll give you some resources for more information or how you might better incorporate work incentive counseling into the services you provide. Next slide, John. So slide 11, PL 106-170. So when the Ticket to Work and Work Incentives Act passed, the law focused not only on the ticket program but also on other provisions that give important support to working beneficiaries. So example, some examples of these provisions.
Marjorie.
Yeah.
Marjorie, I am so sorry. I was disconnected. The operator just reconnected me. I apologize.
No problem. Adele did a great job of introducing me.
Okay, when you and Terry finish, I will make a couple comments. Thank you.
Great. So examples of these provisions include lengthening extended Medicare, allowing states to broaden opportunities to purchase Medicaid for people working people with disabilities, the authority for Social Security to operate demonstration projects to test changes in the program, expedited reinstatement, and access to free advocacy through the protection and advocacy system, and a variety of rehabilitation options through the Ticket to Work. And beneficiaries receiving benefits based on disability can access Social Security work incentives, whether or not they're using a ticket or have assigned a ticket. So as you can see, the Act included not only the ticket program, but so much more. So, and the focus of today's call is actually on Section 1149 of the Act. This created the Work Incentives Planning and Assistance Programs, or WIPA. The Act allowed Social Security to fund community organizations who provide WIPA services, and we do this through a type of grant known as a cooperative agreement. The goal of the WIPA program is to enable beneficiaries with disabilities to receive accurate information so they can plan and make a successful transition to work. WIPAs provide information about work incentives and supports to help beneficiaries who are going to work. As you all know, information is key to this whole back-to-work process. Next slide, please. Slide 12, purpose of WIPA. I know the people on this call know that going to work can be a very scary proposition for our beneficiaries. Our programs and rules can be confusing. Not only do we have two different programs, we have two different sets of rules. And so while we want to encourage beneficiaries to return to work, it can be very complicated. So WIPA gives beneficiaries a safe place to explore the possibility of work and learn about the effect of work on benefits. The goal of the WIPA program is to enable beneficiaries with disabilities to receive accurate information. WIPAs provide information about work incentives and supports to help beneficiaries going to work. A critical part of the counseling WIPA provides is a comprehensive analysis of the person's situation. It's very individualized. Benefits counselors who staff WIPA projects are called Community Work Incentive Coordinators, or CWICs, and they don't just talk about the effect of work on an individual's Social Security benefit. They look at all the benefits a person receives, and they provide an analysis of all these benefits and supports and discuss how work will impact all of them. So it's very big picture. Additionally, they act as a resource for services and supports a person may need that they may not have yet accessed. They also refer people to state vocational rehab agencies and to employment networks. So if losing a benefit, whether it's Social Security, housing, or food stamps, is a surprise, it may derail a work attempt. And if an individual's work income makes them lose their Medicaid or housing subsidy, the beneficiary might quit their job. And this is particularly true when overpayments occur. Next slide, please. WIPA programs. We currently have 83 WIPA projects. They provide coverage in all states and U.S. territories. WIPA projects were chosen through an open competition, and the next competition will be in 2020. WIPA projects cover specific service areas. They don't overlap, it's all based on a beneficiary's zip code. And if you don't know the WIPA in your area, or if you are a national EN and serve lots of different beneficiaries in different areas, you can always access the WIPA through the Find Help tool on the Choose Work website. Under the type of service provider, just click on Benefits Counseling and input the zip code. WIPA services are free to those that meet the eligibility requirement, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. All WIPA staff must meet suitability, and CWICs must undergo a very rigorous training and certification process, which includes a 5-day in-person training followed by extensive online training. It usually takes a little over a year for a CWIC to become fully certified. Next slide, please. Tickets to Work Helpline. I know you are all familiar with that. So how are individuals connected to the WIPA? The most common way is through the Ticket to Work Helpline. As most of you know, Maximus runs our Ticket to Work Helpline. And the customer service reps are not only trained to help beneficiaries access their ticket and connect with employment networks, but they're also trained to provide basic information about Social Security and our work incentives, and they're trained to recognize when callers should be referred to WIPA. If the beneficiary is interested in receiving WIPA services, and if their situation meets the priority requirements for referral, the helpline will make a secure referral to the servicing WIPA through the WIPA National Data System. Next slide. Who is eligible for WIPA services? Well, individuals eligible for WIPA must be over 14 and not yet full retirement age and receiving any of the following benefits based on their own disability: SSDI, including childhood disability benefits, disabled widows benefits, SSI based on blindness or disability, Medicare under the extended period of Medicare coverage, or Medicaid continuation under 1619, or a state supplementary SSI payment. So if you have an individual, a 16-year-old, for example, who's receiving benefits, survivor's benefits, on a deceased parent's record, they would not be eligible for WIPA benefits. However, if that 16-year-old were receiving SSI based on a disability, they would be potentially eligible. Next slide, please. So as you can imagine, the number of individuals who meet the basic eligibility criteria is large, and unfortunately, WIPAs do not have the capacity to serve everyone who meets these guidelines. So we have a priority protocol. This helps with us prioritize services to the people who are closest to working and most vulnerable to overpayments. So, the priorities. The first one, beneficiaries who are working full-time, are self-employed full-time, or are about to work full-time. This group is our number one priority, as these folks are at risk for overpayments. Next, beneficiaries who are self-employed part-time, working for wages part-time, or about to start part-time work. Again, this is a vulnerable group for overpayments, and as many of you know, when beneficiaries receive overpayments, they often decide to stop working. Next, beneficiaries who have had a job interview within 30 days prior, or who have a job interview scheduled in the next 2 weeks. Although this individual is not yet working, they're clearly motivated and interested in working, and we want to support them. And next, transition-aged youth between the ages of 14 and 25 at any stage on the employment continuum. We view this population as a group we really need to support with correct information about work and how work can positively impact their future. If an individual does not meet one of these priorities, the helpline will answer any questions they have and let them know that they're welcome to call back when they're closer to beginning work. If an individual calls a WIPA directly or another agency refers, for example, an EN to a WIPA, the WIPA, again, will provide services based on this priority list and will let them know if they should also recontact if their status changes. Next slide, please. So, as WIPA workload permits, the projects may also serve individuals who fall into a second half of the priority list. This consists of beneficiaries who have indicated a strong interest in working but who are not at immediate need for in-depth individualized benefits counseling or who are not at risk for immediate overpayment. We would like to serve as many people as we can, but as you know, we just don't have the resources. If a WIPA is able to serve someone in this category or other categories, they will, and they will provide basic information and referral resources if they can, but they will use the priority list to govern who they see and in what priority. And now I'm going to turn this over to Terry Odermullen and John, if you can go on to the next slide.
Marjorie's looking at me like, what's your name? Good afternoon, everybody. I am Terry Odermullen, and I am, like Marjorie, a project officer with the WIPA program. And there's a few things that I really want you to take away from this presentation that we're going to get to in a second. But first, what happens after the WIPA gets the referral? And that's a critical time point for the beneficiary because they're curious, and it's risky, it's scary to go to work. So they call the helpline, perhaps, and the helpline gives them information based on a script that we've developed to make sure that it's accurate and that they explain what a WIPA does and ask the person if the WIPA wants or if they want a referral to their local project. And the customer service representative fills out a little bit of information and sends it via a secure system to the Work Incentives Planning and Assistance Project that serves that person. So what happens after that referral? Well, the WIPA project gets an email that says, Joe Schmidt, or actually says, you have a referral in this secure system. And then they look up and they go, oh, yep, Joe Schmidt wants services. So I'm going to call him. And let's just say that I'm the benefits counselor. My job is to serve you. So I get your name, and I get your telephone number, and I get any of the notes that the helpline gave me. And I call you and I say, hey, Joe, I'm really glad to hear that you're interested in working. Let's talk a little bit about the benefits that you get. And they do a kind of an analysis at that moment. Not that they're not telling them how work affects their benefits or telling them anything about their benefits, but kind of what does this person need? What benefits might they want? What do they have already? What do we need to verify and what will I eventually need to tell them? And that the eventually is really important because we do not have benefits counselors give information without verification. Those of you who have worked with beneficiaries for a long time realize that they may not know what they get. A lot of people think they get Social Security benefits when they get Supplemental Security Income, or they get SSI and they think they just say they get a check from Social Security. And a lot of times the benefits counselor will need to find out things about housing, where the person lives and the subsidy that they have, or what kind of food stamps they get, or other special programs that affect their lives. For example, a Medicaid waiver program that might provide home and community-based services to help that person stay out of a nursing home. So the Work Incentives Counselor, the CWIC, Community Work Incentives Coordinator, will sit there and talk to the person, get to know them, establish a relationship, find out what their situation is, try to identify services that might help them, possibly refer them to ENs in the community, possibly refer them to VR. They verify the benefits. Then they work with the person to explain what the benefits are. And once they've done that, they write an analysis. And that analysis is documentation of the individualized benefits counseling the person receives. Now, not everybody who goes to a WIPA gets this letter. It's really only for people who have a complicated situation, are working, and really need the individualized information. And the letter documents what the Work Incentives Coordinator told the person and also acts as a referral for them, a reference for them to use later. If the person has a particularly complicated situation or they need to get stuff or do stuff in order to get to work, the Work Incentives Counselor will work with the beneficiary to develop a Work Incentives Plan. And that's just a to-do list. It says things like, okay, after you've worked for this many months, you're going to need to go to Social Security and report your wages. Or you've said that you want to contact this employment network. Let's set a date for you to do that so that the person has it written out in step-by-step, these are the things that need to happen. And there should be some steps on there for the benefits counselor to recontact them, to give them the analysis, to check on them at critical time points. This can be a long-term relationship, and often is. If the person has a complicated benefits situation, they may need that Work Incentives Coordinator to call them up in a couple months and say, you know, it looks to me from my list here that it's time for you to report to Social Security, that you're almost at the end of your trial work period. And do you need me to help you do that? I just wanted to remind you. I just wanted to check in on you. Or very often the beneficiary will call the Work Incentives Coordinator when something comes up that's confusing or a little scary, or they get a letter. So it's a long-term relationship to support the person and keep them working. As Marjorie said, it's very, very likely that people get overpaid when they go to work. If they don't report right away, those overpayments can be huge. So it's really, really important that they get the support that they need to make the reports that they need to make. So let's talk a little bit about reporting. Next slide. As employment networks, you have a responsibility to report to us, to our agency, when people have wages so that you can get paid. This is the one thing, if you take nothing else away from this phone call, I want you all to understand that that does not meet the beneficiary's requirement to report. We have to have the beneficiary contact us to report that they're working. Sometimes, in some situations, the wages that you give us might trigger us to contact the beneficiary, but it's really better if the beneficiary contacts us. They have the responsibility and they have the information we need. Next slide. If a person is receiving Social Security disability insurance, in order to determine whether or not their benefits can continue, we have to do a work review. And a work review is a very detailed process that looks at what the person earns, whether or not they had sick pay. Let's say the person may have $2,000 in wages, but it was all vacation time. That's not substantial work. So that's something that we might say, oops, this isn't part of of establishing a decision about how work will affect your benefits. We take that away. We have work incentives that we can apply, such as the trial work period, such as deductions for special situations. We call it subsidy, but when somebody, maybe they work for a family member, or they, I remember back many years ago when I was a claims representative, I had a young man who was reporting his work, and essentially he just swept the floor of a bar, and the guy had another cleaner who came in and actually did the work. But he gave this young man money because he wanted to help him out. And in that case, that work didn't affect him, didn't affect his benefits. So it's a decision, and it's a decision made up of factors. The same thing, next slide, on SSI, Supplemental Security Income, is a needs-based benefit. And it doesn't just look at earnings. With SSI, you look at who's the person living with? Where do they live? Are they married? Do they have, are they getting support from somebody else? SSI is very sensitive to resources. How much money does the person have in the bank? These are decisions that Social Security has to make about the person's earnings. So just because you're reporting the wages to us, that's helpful and important and a very important part of the ticket program. But in order for the person to have an accurate decision about their benefits, they have to report to us. And we have to get the receipts and other information that we need. Next slide. One of the pieces of the work report that applies to both SSI and Social Security Disability Insurance that's really important, and we will not know exists unless the beneficiary tells us, are impairment-related work expenses. Those are goods or services that are necessary for work. They're paid out of pocket. They're not reimbursed by anybody else. They have to be reasonable. They're paid in the month of the work. Under the Social Security Disability Insurance Program, we can deduct the amount that they spent for this cost when we're deciding whether or not the work is substantial. Under the SSI program, it actually literally affects how much the person gets paid. We don't know about these costs unless the person reports them. And anybody helping this beneficiary go to work, you want to help them save those receipts, understand what the impairment-related work expenses are, what they could be, and what I've always told people over the years is, when in doubt, if you think it might be necessary for work, paid out of pocket, related to an impairment, being treated by a healthcare provider, reasonable, and paid in the month, or if it's not the month the person's working and it's a durable piece of equipment, Social Security can prorate it over a year. So, somebody's blowing their lawn, I think. So the bottom line is we want work to pay, because if work pays,
please make sure or ensure that your lines are on mute. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. So it's really important that people hang on to those receipts, that they report their information to us accurately and fully so that they can access the work incentives, because people are going to stay working if work pays, and they're going to quit if work doesn't pay. It's just natural. We all want to pay our light bill. Next slide. Under the SSI program, only the SSI program, this does not exist in the Social Security world, there is a work incentive called blind work expenses. And these are different from impairment-related work expenses, because a person who meets the definition of statutory or legal blindness, Social Security can deduct anything, any expense that they have that's related to work. It doesn't have to be related to a disability. It does have to be reasonable. It does have to be necessary for the person to work, but it can be things like taxes and union dues and child care costs and transportation and other things that are not deducted as impairment-related work expenses. Again, we want work to pay, so people will stay working. So it's important that if the person is blind, they understand that these are possible deductions. But this only applies to the SSI program. Under the Social Security program, when we're doing those work decisions, there's higher earnings limit allowed for blind people, but they do not have blind work expenses. Next slide. One of the things that's really critical for work reports is that beneficiaries keep track of their stuff. And by that I mean the receipts for expenses, their pay stubs. They should keep records of who they report what to, who they talk to. If they call the Medicaid office to report their earnings and they talk to, I'm having trouble coming up with a creative name, they talk to Tasha. Clarissa. You know, we all know Clarissa. And Clarissa doesn't, you know, she may not give them the right information, or she may give them the right information and they may not remember it. So it's really good for beneficiaries to keep a notebook and say, I talked to Clarissa on this day. This is what Clarissa told me, and this is what I told Clarissa. They may not want to write that much down, but even if they just can prove that they made the report, if they keep their pay stubs, keep any letters they get from benefit providers, including Social Security, keep a notebook, a calendar. A lot of times people aren't that organized, but it's really helpful when they make their work reports if they have that level of detail when they come to us. Go to the next slide. My word for this next slide, these are resources for you to use. And I originally titled it, Don't Do This at Home, because I don't want people to guess. When you give information to beneficiaries, don't guess about how work affects them. I've talked to many beneficiaries over the years who have either misunderstood or been given misinformation. There's something I call the Bush Network, which is where they stand and talk to their neighbors next door over the privet hedge, and they're talking about what happened to their benefits and what they need to know, and they trust that neighbor, and the neighbor is absolutely wrong and steers them. If you don't have a certified benefits counselor on staff, or you don't have the person is not in a situation where they're appropriate for a WIPA referral, use our resources. Our website is actually accessible. It's good. There's a lot of really good pamphlets. The ones that are on here are the ones that are kind of my go-to for people. Working While Disabled, How We Can Help. If you're blind or have low vision, How We Can Help. The Red Book is a more comprehensive look at both programs. And that one I wouldn't pass out all the time. I would hang on to the Working While Disabled, How We Can Help one more. And then if people have more information, they can go to the Red Book. But it is a good resource. And then the last one is Spotlights. The SSI Spotlights are a really good resource for Supplemental Security Income. They have spotlights that describe how resources affect their benefits, how the student-earned income exclusion, which is if somebody's under age 22 and they're in school and they have earnings, we can write off a good bit of their earnings so that they get more SSI. Sorry for the momentary distraction here. Okay, next slide. It is possible to get more training, and there's this particular slide. Our contractor, Virginia Commonwealth University, has created a really good introductory web course. They offer it 8 times a year. It's free. You just have to go to VCU's website. We've got the link on the slide, and you sign up, and it's a six-lesson, three-week course. They're very well done, and they give you a good overview of what work incentive planning and assistance is, when referrals are appropriate, what work incentives affect people's work. I can't recommend it highly enough. I think it's a really good beginning. It is a beginning. This is not that course that Marjorie was talking about, where people go and they sit for a week, and then they do testing for weeks, and then they have to submit benefit summary and analysis sees that they've written, you know, that's the next slide, which is it, or not the next slide, sorry, back up, which is the CWIC training, but for EN staff, we call them Community Partner Work Incentive Counselors. And a Community Partner Work Incentive Counselor gets the same initial training, and if they're successful, they get technical assistance, and they have to do ongoing To retain the certification, they have to do ongoing training. And now we can go to the next slide. Oh, actually, Yeah, sorry. Go to the next slide. On the Ticket to Work website, VCU and Maximus collaborated to create a another, like, how to coordinate with your local WIPA. It's a two-part training. Also a very good resource that we highly recommend. Next slide. Who is appropriate for CWIC training? This is another one, a really important takeaway. If that we have limited resources, we are allowing a 5 to 7 EN staff to go to a training in addition to WIPA staff. And there are 8 trainings a year, so that's 40 people, roughly. And if you send somebody, make sure that you realize this is a lot of work. This is critical for the beneficiaries that you serve, that they get good, accurate benefits counseling from somebody who can communicate the complexity in a way that people can understand, people at different learning levels. It's critical that people have time to do the training, that they have time to do the testing, that they have time to access technical assistance, and that they retain their certification with ongoing training. It's a perishable skill, very complicated. People can lose it pretty fast. And the one goal, the one thing that will cause people to quit working fast is if they get misinformation and they get overpaid. So if anyone in your project wants to become a benefits counselor, make sure that your project is willing to make the investment. Give them time and use them. Once they're certified, for the WIPAs, we don't let people retain certification unless they're doing benefits counseling, working directly with beneficiaries, at least 40% of a full-time schedule. And it's better if it's more, because this is very complicated information and you want beneficiaries to get with somebody who knows the right answers and knows where to find the answers they don't have. So that's another takeaway. Just make sure that if you decide to enroll somebody and you get someone in a WIPA class to become a community work incentive counselor, a community partner work incentive counselor, that you give them time and that you use their services, because they'll lose it otherwise. All right. Next slide, quick review. Work incentives planning and assistance projects are your partners. Their services are free. They're your partners because we all want beneficiaries to be successful, and they need information to be successful. They need to understand what's going to happen to their benefits. They need to be able to do a cost-benefit analysis. You know, many of us who are working are thinking about, okay, I have these bills and I have this income, and how will I take care of my retirement? Financial planning, and benefits counseling is a kind of financial planning. It's also a little bit of a case management, what benefits do you need, what services are out there that you might not know about. So it's a very valuable resource, and it's a piece of the back-to-work process that's critical. It is a limited resource. That's why we have the priorities that we have. And I'll tell you from the slide earlier, we get as many as 100 people registering for a class that we will only allow the maximum in the class is 30, and it's usually around 20 or 25, and we usually only allow 5 to 7 EN staff. So, again, it's valuable to take it seriously. And I think we're going to – oh, the one thing I haven't said yet, and I think Marjorie alluded to this, the primary referral source for WIPA is the Ticket to Work helpline. They get approximately 76% of the referrals from the helpline. We did that on purpose because we want the work incentives planning and assistance projects to be able to use their highly skilled services working with beneficiaries rather than doing outreach and dealing with people who aren't ready to work yet. But if you have a beneficiary who is appropriate for a WIPA referral, please send them to the Ticket to Work helpline. If you have established a relationship with a WIPA in your area, if you're a smaller EN, you're not doing the whole country, it might be good to call that Work Incentive Planning and Assistance Project and talk to them about the best ways for them to get a referral directly if you have somebody who's in an urgent situation. But you can you've got the Ticket to Work helpline number on this slide. Don't be afraid to use it. The customer service representatives have had a lot of training, and they can give good basic information about what happens to benefits. And if the person is appropriate for WIPA referral, they can send them on.
Terry, only because there was a question similar to what you're referring to right now, I'll ask. Stacy wants to know, is an EN able to refer directly to a WIPA or CWIC, or should the EN have their beneficiaries call the Ticket to Work helpline for WIPA referrals?
I think either way, if an EN refers directly to a WIPA, you want to make sure that that person meets the service criteria, that they receive benefits, that they're about to go to work, or they're working, everything that we had on that slide. I think it's really valuable if you're going to refer directly to a WIPA, that you contact that WIPA and say, I have this beneficiary, or you say, I'd like to refer beneficiaries to you in the future. What's the best way to do it? Otherwise, the Ticket to Work helpline, if they call them, the WIPAs have to get back within a day or two, and they usually do. The statistics that we have on most of them is that they get back within a day.
Wonderful. That was another question in the chat. You are on a roll.
All right. What other questions do you have?
We will be opening the line if you've concluded your presentation.
I have.
Okay. Well, we will be opening up the lines, and Bethany will help us with that. But meanwhile, there were a few questions in the chat, and you've already answered two of them. Another question, the WIPA training programs follow an order of selection process at BCU have filled up quickly lately. And as an EN, is there anything that we can do to be chosen for this training? So basically they're asking if they can be moved up because they're an EN.
Actually, we have just changed the training priorities, and we've moved ENs up. You are the highest priority group after WIPA for the training, but we have to limit the number because when we make a commitment to send somebody to training, VCU has to do a lot of work with that person. They do a lot of grading. They do a lot of hand-holding, a lot of editing and supporting the person through the process, and providing technical assistance, which is another reason that it's really important that if somebody goes through the training and they go through the Community Partner Work Incentive Counseling certification, that they use that skill. This is not something for somebody who's just every once in a while kind of wants to answer a question, because that person who every once in a while just kind of wants to answer a question is most often going to give the wrong answer. So it's very important that people who go invest the time, energy, and commitment to do it well.
Thank you. One more question before we open up and have participants ask the questions. Do you know if it's typical for an EN to get trained to be a CWIC?
As I said, we allow 5 to 7 EN staff in a training when it's the highest priority after WIPA. Now, we will have 80, 90, 100 people register for any given class. Mm. There are a lot of people who want this training, but we have to limit it to the resources that we have. It's free to the people who go, and including the technical assistance. We pay for that with the contract. So we have to be very judicious in who all we allow to participate because of the limitations that we have to support VCU.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Again, I want to express my thanks for the information on behalf of CPM for providing this information. And what we will do now is open up the line. Bethany, if you can help us out.
Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question over the phone, you may signal by pressing *1 on your telephone keypad.
This is Carol. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, hi, Carol. Yes.
Hi. Oh, no, that's okay. I'm listening intently. I love it. can I just remind everyone who, anyone who's not speaking to go on mute, there's tremendous background noise. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Carol. Any questions?
And we do have a,
go ahead.
We do have some questions over the phone.
Okay, wonderful.
And caller, your line is open.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi. One of my questions that I have, well, that's just a twofold question, is that I overheard you said that in terms of individuals that are blind, that they have that the incentives that they have in terms of the amount of their earnings can be upward to $2,000, I believe it was, and that was the only incentive that they had. That's one of my questions.
No.
And
well,
go ahead.
There's what I was saying is that in under the Social Security Disability Program, there is a higher limit for substantial gainful activity, and I think it is $1,890 this year per month. I'd have to double check that number. So it's but it's over $1,800 a month. And
right.
Under
mm-hmm.
the SSI program, there are special expenses that the Social Security Administration can deduct when they're deciding how work will affect an SSI payment.
Okay. So with someone in terms of being blind that's receiving SSDI, they will not get the same work incentives that the SSI blind would get, right?
That is correct. They do not have access to blind work expenses. They have the same work incentives that all other disability beneficiaries do on the SSDI program with a slightly higher, well, actually considerably higher, substantial gainful activity level.
Okay, okay. And the second question I had was, I know you have what they call the trial work period, which is 9 months, but from my understanding, there is the additional months where you have extended period of eligibility, and then you have a grace period. So that comes up to, from my understanding, it's 12 months total that an individual have that they allow to work without their benefits being affected. Is that correct?
If the person receives Social Security Disability Insurance, SSDI,
mm-hmm.
and they're going
right.
to work, and they earn over a certain amount in a given month, they use one trial work period month. They have 9 trial work period months. After the trial work period is over, the extended period of eligibility, which is 36 months long, begins. And during the extended period of eligibility, if the person performs what we consider substantial work, they will get a cessation, and the cessation has 2 grace months to follow it, so it is 3 months. But they don't all net run together. The only things that have in that scenario that run together is that last month of the trial work period and the first month of the extended period of eligibility. The trial work period can be spread over up to 5 years. But
I understand. Okay.
Okay?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I understand that, you know, you have 36 months, but I thought from understanding that actually it comes up to about 1 year of the trial work period, because when you add the grace month and plus the extended period of eligibility, it totals about 12 months.
You got to separate those concepts, but I would suggest that you look at Working While Disabled, how we can help, and read the section on the trial work period. It's kind of complicated,
right.
but it is a valuable resource.
Hi, Terry, it's Mel, and I was just wondering, the reference, the gentleman that you're asking, are you talking about cessation? Maybe you're just...
Yes,
are you
yes,
talking
yes,
about
the cessation months. Yes, the cessation months that you get and the extended period of eligibility, those months.
So, Terry, it could be the grace period and cessation. I wonder if the extended period of eligibility is just being used incorrectly here, if that makes a difference in your...
That makes a difference.
Grace period, but what my concern about adding it to the trial work period is it may not happen for a couple of years. If a person, the trial work level is lower than substantial gainful activity. So let's say the person earns $900 a month, which is over the trial work period and under SGA, and they earn $900 a month for the 9 months of the trial work period, and then 2 years later they finally earn above substantial gainful activity. That's when the grace period happens. So I'm hesitant to say that they go together because they don't always.
Oh, okay. I see.
Phrase of concept. If you keep it as a concept, it doesn't go together. So I like that you use that terminology. And Colin Starr, could you identify yourself? What is your name?
John DePlessis.
Mm-hmm. Oh, hi, John.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good. Thank you so much for your question.
Yes, I was just getting some clarification, that's all.
Wonderful. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
All right. And just a reminder for those on the phone, please ensure that your lines are muted. Bethany, we have more questions?
We do. We'll move to our next one.
Hello? Who's on the line?
Caller, your line is open. Please check your mute function. And hearing no response, we'll take our next caller in line. Your line
Thank
is
you.
Open.
All right, who's on the line?
Hello, I'm not sure. This is Stacey Clark. I'm not sure who actually is next and how you know if you're up. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're up, Stacey.
Okay, perfect. I had no idea if it was me or who. So, hello. I just have a question to go back about something one of the speakers said about reporting pay subs income. I need to clarify that because you mentioned that the beneficiary, I know they're ultimately responsible for reporting their income to Social Security, and I would like to hear some feedback on that. The best way to do that is what I've been told, they need to present that to their local field office on a monthly basis. Is that correct?
Different field offices operate differently, and it depends on the program. The reason I'm hesitant is if the person is receiving Social Security disability insurance and if their earnings are under trial work, say, the field office isn't going to want to see it every month. It's better.
Right.
It is good to be consistent. If you work in an area with a specific field office or you're working with a work incentives planning and assistance project, you might want to find out what would be best for that individual. If they're receiving SSI, we have ways to report online. We have ways to report by phone, but you won't access the work incentives that way. So in that case, it is best to go to the field office, and they'll do you estimate the earnings, and then about once a year, I'm looking at Marjorie because she's our SSI expert in the room, about once a year they would do a redetermination and look at the income and look at the work incentives and determine how that would affect the person's SSI.
Just to clarify my question, and thank you for answering that. My clients, yes, they're actually all SSDI that I do serve as an EIN, and I only have them, I do have them submit all the pay stubs to me. I help them analyze, you know, where they're at or about where they're at, like you said, with trial work level. If they're over that amount, I know it's important for them to report that to their, and I have met with all my local field offices, and I've understand how they would like that reported. And it does vary by field office. You're absolutely right. How often they want it, how they want it presented. Some want it faxed, some want it brought in, some want it mailed. They're all different ways. And I just want to make sure that is still correct, so it sounds like it is truly by field office.
It is truly by field office. And Marjorie was going to say something.
Well, actually, I was going to say something about SSI, but it sounds like all her clients are SSDI, so
correct. A lot of people.
Well,
right.
That's true. So just one point I want to make about SSI, just Terry had said we take the pay stubs and then we estimate the earnings and we look at them. With SSI, when individuals bring in their pay stubs, we enter them on the system in real time so that the person doesn't get overpaid. So we actually enter them on the system if we have verified pay stubs so that we can keep them from getting overpaid. So it's great if they report monthly. And also I just wanted to add that it sounds, Stacey, like you've done a great job of connecting with your field office and finding out how they want the information, which is awesome. I do want to just add, though, for folks, when individuals go into field offices to report their wages, if they're able to, I know it can be a hassle in some areas, but if they can do that and they are comfortable doing that, when they go in and report their wages, they do get a receipt. So, you know, there's no harm in people going in monthly if that works for them.
And they can keep those receipts in that notebook that I was talking about. And I think it's really important that they keep those receipts.
Right. Okay, thank you. Yes. Just want to make sure they were doing it the right way. Okay, thank you.
And we will take our next caller. And when you do hear the prompt, please announce your name.
Who's on the line?
Caller, your line is open. Please check your mute function.
Hello?
Hi.
Can you hear me? I'm up next.
Yes.
Awesome. I didn't know. I kept saying hello about five times. This is Teresa. I'm with Employment Options. How is everybody today? It's a great meeting.
Thank you for your patience, Teresa. Wonderful. And your question?
My question is, what is the likelihood of an EN obtaining a second CWIC certification?
You mean having a second person go?
Yes, I'm the current CWIC for Employment Options.
Okay. You're actually a Community Partner Work Incentive Counselor. We
right.
separate the titles. The CWIC actually is a person who works for a WIPA, just so you know that.
Okay.
But
okay.
It's just as likely to get a second one as it is to get a first one. The person needs to register as soon as the training registration opens, and hopefully they'll get in. Again, it's a very limited number that we can take. But we're not going to preclude somebody from going because they already have a community partner work incentive counselor at the EN.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Terry.
You're welcome.
And we will take our next caller.
Hi, this is Sabrina Stamps. How's everyone this afternoon?
Wonderful. I'm sorry, I missed your name. Who is it again?
Sabrina.
Hi, Sabrina.
Hey, how are you?
Wonderful.
Good.
What's your question
Great.
Today?
My question is regarding oftentimes when I go in the portal and I'm looking at a consumer's I'm about to submit payment or I'm checking to see if they're assigned, it will say something like TWL 5 months only. So does that mean they only have 5 months of trial work level left? And if so, how do I know what phase they're on in terms of submitting a payment? Now, I have called the EN payments line, and unfortunately, oftentimes they're not aware of how to make that determination on where they stand with the payment as far as which payment level they're on. So I'm a little confused as to how I find out that information. Hello?
Hi, I'm sorry. I just wanted to check something. This is Marjorie. One thing I want to point out is that there's two different things, and Terry sort of alluded this with, like, reporting wages. When you report income to us so that you can get paid as an EN, that's a very different process, and, you know, with the payments you receive, the phase payments you receive and whatnot. Yes, thank
milestone.
You. Milestone payments. That's different than the beneficiary, what the rules we have for them regarding trial work period. So those are two different things. So are you asking about getting something related to the payments, or are you saying that when you submit the payments, you're trying to figure out where they are in the trial work process?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out where they are, because if it says TWL 5 months only or only 5 months, so how far down are they in the milestone level? Are they at a 3 already, or are they at a 2? So that's where I'm running into a problem. You know, exactly which milestone should I be filing at that point?
Okay. Sabrina.
Yes, uh-huh.
I have a question for you. We can't see the portal. So may I ask, do you know which phase one milestone payments that you received already? Because the trial work level,
So if it's telling you 5 months only, maybe whatever phase one milestone you're requesting, you're not eligible for that next one yet because you're only 5 months in. Does that make sense? So, for example,
it does, but
three is 6 months.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
You need 6 months of earnings above trial work level, at or above trial work level, to receive phase one milestone 3. So that, I'm assuming that's what the portal is telling you, that because you only have 5 months of the earnings at or above trial work level, you're not yet eligible for phase one milestone 3. That is just my assumption because I can't see the portal, but that's what it sounds like.
Okay.
The trial work
level is
trial work period. I want to make that clear too.
Right. I misspoke on that last part. It's really when I'm looking at a ticket assignment and it provides the information whether or not that particular individual is assigned to another EN or if they are assignable. And it also gives the information as to if there have been any payments in the last 24 months. And occasionally I will run across where it will say TWL 5 months only or TWL 3. Or something to that aspect. So I'm wondering, you know, in terms of even advising them, where do they stand in terms of how many months of their trial work period do they have remaining?
Yeah, hi, Sabrina.
Carol.
This is Marjorie.
This is Carol, and I'd like to make a suggestion that perhaps we contact directly after this call so we can finish up some questions about the WIPA, just because we're really closing in on the
Sure, no problem. Sure.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Operator, this is Marjorie. I just want to say one quick thing to everybody out there that might be helpful because we didn't touch on this call, but one of the tools that CWICs use and also folks at ENs can use if they have proper signed releases is a document we call the Benefits Planning Query, which is the BPQI. If you request a BPQI from Social Security from the field office, it will tell you where the person is in their trial, how many trial work periods they've used or trial work months they've used. Just want to throw that out there for folks.
If they have reported the work.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
And if we have adjudicated the work and we've looked at
it
and said how many we've used. So if the BPQI can be a very valuable tool. If it's showing that the trial work period has been used, then you're golden. But if it's just showing a few months or not showing any months, then we have to look at other things. So you want to check. And that's not going to have anything to do with what you're asking about payments. So we'll have to get that to you offline since we don't have the answer.
Okay. Well, we'll be in touch with Sabrina. While we queue up another question from the participants on the phone, in the chat, I see a question from Mary G. She's indicated that she's read that SSDI can now report earnings via My Social Security account. Can you discuss what are some limitations? Is it like SSI, you can only report the first 6 days of the month, or can you just update whenever you get a stub?
Go ahead.
Sure.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes, that is a new service, and it is for SSDI beneficiaries only. You can report at any time. It doesn't have the six-day limitation that SSI has. And if you have beneficiaries who receive SSI or who are concurrent, it's only going to report for the SSDI portion. Some limitations. One of the things that you need to know is that when the beneficiary goes into their MySSA account, it will show employers that they have listed. If the employer is not there, for example, maybe they've just started working there, they actually will need to go into Social Security and report that they are working so that we can get the employer in the system with an EIN. And then the next time they go in, it will show up and they can report. And it's new, so we're still getting some feedback, but those are the basics.
The other thing that's important to know is although they're putting it into Social Security, they're giving the information, remember earlier I talked about the work review, that's going to go into our system. It's information that we need, but it is not going to give us information at this point anyway about work incentives their Social Security is not going to make an immediate decision about those wages. The person still needs to report. They need to go into Social Security if they have work incentives or other things so that we can make a decision about how that work affects their benefits.
But they will also get a receipt when they report the wages, which is great.
Yeah. All
right. Thank you, ladies. There's another question in the chat regarding subsidy. If trial work period and the extended period of eligibility are used and a beneficiary has an employer subsidy in place, if they can earn SGA even with the subsidy in place, will the employer subsidy stay in effect for any months following the month that triggered SGA, or is the employer subsidy lost?
Well, okay, I can answer this question. First, for those of you who are not familiar with subsidy, we allow deductions from wages for supports that a person gets because of their disability that somebody else might not get. For example, they get to take a lot of breaks, or they get extra help, or they have a job coach. There are things that Social Security allows. Maybe the person is only half as productive because of their disability. Social Security allows some deductions for that. Subsidy is a work decision that, or work incentive that can be used at any point during anytime we adjudicate a work situation, anytime we look at it and say, this is how this is going to affect it, subsidy applies. So it would depend on the person's earnings, it would depend on the amount of subsidy, it would depend on whether or not their benefits were terminated. But it is one of the work incentives. There are two, impairment-related work expenses and subsidy, that can apply throughout the process, even during the extended period of eligibility or after the person's benefits have been suspended at some point and then restarted.
Hey, thank you for that. We can take one more question from the line, and then we'll have to call it a day because we are approaching the 4:30 hour. Is there another question by any chance, Bethany?
Absolutely. And your line is open.
Your line is now open.
Who's on the line?
Caller, your line is open. Please check your mute function.
Well, there seems to be an echo on that line, too. Okay, let's try one more.
And caller, your line is open.
Hello?
Hi, who's on the line?
Okay, hi, this is Hamid, and I'm calling about the TWP counseling. It's 9 months. Is it 9 months above or over the SGA? And when you're looking at the TWL as well, if it's below the TWL, does that count against their nine-month period? Does it go against that if they're under the TWL?
Okay, I'm going to do a down-and-dirty description of the trial work period, and then I want to, rather than us doing any more questions, I think Carol wanted to make an announcement.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
The trial work period is a nine-month period. The months do not have to be consecutive. A person uses a trial work month if they earn over a certain amount, and the amount changes every year. If you use 9 trial work months within a 5-year period, you've used your entire trial work period. The level changes, as I said, every year the amount of the trial work changes. I'm not sure if that answered your question, but once you've used it up, it's gone. It's like a friend of mine, when she does training on this, she talks about having a squirt bottle with 9 squirts, and you don't have to use them all at once.
I have a – sorry to interrupt. So it doesn't follow the SGA. It follows the trial work period, correct? When the 9 months run out, then it goes to the SGA. Is that correct?
When the 9 months from the trial work period, when the 9 months have been expended and you're in the extended period of eligibility – if the Social Security Administration uses this substantial gainful activity level that applies for that year. You're correct.
I thought I heard someone say something different, and I had a little confusion. So thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for clarifying.
Carol, are you still on the line?
I sure am.
You want to close this out?
I do. I do. Hi, everybody. And I feel as if, I hope you feel the same way. I hear this, I live this, I read this, and yet every time I hear my fantastic team speak, I learn something new. Terry and Marjorie, that was just outstanding. Just so well done and so filled with important information. So, ladies and gentlemen, and the EN Network, I want to thank you. I want to express our gratitude to you for your continued support of the ticket program, your dedication, and your passion to assisting our beneficiaries and helping them on their road to employment. We are so grateful to you, and anything we can do for you to support you and to further your mission, please do not ever hesitate. And certainly I'm always available to chat with you. And to those of you that I haven't met, I do hope to meet with you someday or speak with you someday. And with that, I just want to let you know that I am retiring. My last day will be Friday, December 29th of this year. Believe it or not, I've been saying that for 2 years. My team's probably, like, you know, sweeping me out the door. It's enough already. With that, I will tell you that it's a very challenging transition, you know, exciting, and at moments, you know, very, very challenging, very painful. So it's really tough because I have absolutely loved every minute of working with the programs, the ticket programs, the WIPAs, the PABs, all of it. And I've enjoyed meeting you and talking with you and just basking in the pleasure of your company and your enthusiasm and your commitment to improving employment options and employment opportunities for the many beneficiaries who we seek to support. So with that, I just want to wish you the very best. I extend to you wishes for a healthy and happy holiday season. And I'm around until the 29th, and please don't ever hesitate to contact me. I think you all know my email. And good luck to everybody. And Terry and Marjorie, Tom, I think, is off the call. And to the entire staff and contract folks, thank you so much.
Thank you, Carol. Very heartfelt congratulations to you. This is Adele and TPM. Again, like to express our thanks for everyone for helping out today. I know we're running just over a few minutes, but only last reminder is that our next call will be February 15th, and we'll leave the chat open for a little bit if you wanted to enter any questions, then we'll get back to you on those. With that said, everyone, have a great rest of the day. Till the next call.
And ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude today's conference. We thank you all for your participation. You may now disconnect.